Hello, and welcome to Tax Talks. I'm Sharon Ferris at CEREC, the Canadian Education and Research Institute for Counseling. Thanks for joining me for this series of discussions with authors of CEREC's new Career Development Practice in Canada textbook. We're happy to bring you insights from these thought leaders in the career development field in Canada. Today, we're speaking with Brian Hebert and Chris Magnuson. Brian Hebert is a professor emeritus of education at the University of Calgary and adjunct professor in educational psychology and leadership studies at the University of Victoria. He is a member of the Canadian Working Group on Evidence-Based Practice in Career Development and part of the coordinating team for Prove It Works, an international initiative aimed at demonstrating the value of career development programs and services. Chris Magnuson is a professor of counseling psychology and Dean of the Faculty of Education at Simon Fraser University. He is also a founding member of the Canadian Research Working Group on Evidence-Based Practice in Career Development, dedicated to improving the evidence base for the impact that career services have at individual, community, social, and economic levels. Their chapter in the Career Development Practice in Canada textbook looks at how practitioners and the field as a whole can show that what they do makes a difference. Hello, Brian and Chris.
Hello, thank you.
Hello.
Wonderful to have you both with me. So, Brian, let me start with you. In setting the scene for your chapter, you talk about how agencies, departments, and individuals providing career development are continuously vulnerable to funding cuts. Is that the biggest motivator for adopting an evidence-based approach?
Well, Sharon, it's hard for me to say what the biggest motivator is. That's certainly a strong motivator. But it also is the case that very, very few counselor education programs teach students how to evaluate their work with clients. And so they're hard-pressed to provide any evidence for client progress, save personal testimonials. It's also the case that counselors tend to generalize from their own experience. You know, basically, this worked for me, so it'll probably work for you. And we believe that actually clients deserve to have more than that as a rationale for beginning an intervention. So I guess for me, it boils down to would you invest in a program that has no track record of success, or if the only evidence of effectiveness was the verbal testimony of the people delivering the program? I think the answer to that most often is going to be no.
Now, Chris, let me bring you into the conversation. In the textbook, you cite a survey where 90% of managers and practitioners in career development say that evaluation is important, but then only 35% actually say that they're evaluating the impact of their work. Why that discrepancy?
I think there are several reasons that situation exists. Sometimes they'll claim that they are not funded directly for evaluation, at least not of the comprehensive impact assessment that we have described. They are required to provide data on impacts, like job placements, but not on what contributed to achieving those impacts. They also often perceive that they are so busy in the provision of the services, they just don't have time to add evaluation mechanisms into the mix. As Brian alluded to, training programs don't usually include impact assessment, and so they're trained in the provision of services, but not in the evaluation of the impact of those services. And I think there's still an attitude that evaluation is something that gets bolted on at the end of an intervention, not as something that needs to be designed as part of the intervention. So it's a bit of a mindset shift from, you know, we provide good services, but it's somebody else's job to measure what those impacts are. And the shift that needs to happen is to say that actually it's our job as professionals to design the intervention as well.
Now, Brian, you hinted at this in your opening comment, but in the text, there's a particularly strong statement that's made, and it is that it is neither professional nor ethical to do things with a client with no evidence to support it. But as you suggested, Chris, this seems to be happening with some regularity. So Brian, tell me about the statement.
Well, I think it's not ethical to have the philosophy, if it worked for me, it'll work for you. Basically, what's good for me is good for the whole world. And I'm certainly not egocentric enough to believe that. We believe instead that a professional counselor would have a set of indicators of success discussed in advance with the client, and then use those indicators of success as a gauge of progress. And in of course, the gauge might need adjusting as the counseling progresses, but there should be some tangible evidence that the client is actually changing, and we believe that's a professional and an ethical way to behave.
So, Chris, you go on to make the argument that the field of career development needs to really reconceptualize how it thinks about evaluation. So not just asking broadly if a client found a session useful or not just tracking changes in employment status. Instead, what you're proposing is an approach where evaluation is infused into day-to-day practice. So how would this work?
Well, it's something I alluded to earlier, where we need to think of evaluation as actually part of the intervention, not as an add-on to the intervention. Time and again in the work that we do, we have found that when we're working with practitioners, conceptualizing how you know if something is working actually makes the intervention providers pay more attention to the intervention itself. So in other words, they tend to be more conscientious about what we sometimes call the treatment fidelity, or, you know, sticking to the program, as it were. And definitely, they become way more intentional in their interventions. So the combination of increased intentionality, you know, I'm focusing much more clearly on the things I'm trying to do, and the ability to pinpoint what parts of an intervention seem to be producing the greatest impacts, leads to far better practice. So it's those two pieces that we need to work in.
Is there an example, I wonder, Chris, that you might give of an intervention where evaluation is infused into it?
We did an interesting project where we worked with employment agencies, and we were trying to determine how labor market information might benefit clients. So what's the impact of labor market information? But to do that, we had to get the practitioners to do a bit of screening to see what was the kind of need for information that the clients would have. Well, as they focused on, you know, well, we'll have to define what steps we're taking, and we'll have to have some kind of a protocol to properly triage the clients before we provide them the information, they found that focusing on that process made them much sharper in their initial interviews with clients, and it led to far better practice.
Okay.
They found it also to, it's Brian speaking, they found it also to be a strong motivator for them. They were more enthusiastic around working with the clients because they also could see the gauge of the client success happening.
You mentioned the client success, and I guess another way of talking about that would be client change. So, Chris, in the book, you draw on two trends, evidence-based practice and outcome-focused intervention. And you use these trends to come up with two fundamental questions that you say practitioners should always ask themselves. What are these two questions, and how do they work in practice?
Well, the first one is simply, well, what intervention would be appropriate for this client? There are a number of examples of agency work that may be funded by a particular branch of government that tend to take almost a one-size-fits-all approach to their service delivery. And it's not necessarily the case that all interventions work equally for all clients. So we need to better understand how do we align the kind of intervention that we're thinking of doing with the client and the client need. So that's the first critical question. What does this person actually need, and what intervention is best going to solve that need? And then the second one is, well, if that's the intervention, how do the client and I know if it's actually working? So instead of relying on what we sometimes tongue-in-cheek call, you know, the happy face evaluations, you know, where you have the five smiley faces to frowny faces and,
smiley sheet,
and
yes,
using that to determine if something is working, we need to have better data mechanisms to track sort of the baseline level the client's at, what sorts of behavioral or thinking or attitude changes that we can see, and to be able to track that, not just from start to end of an intervention, but throughout the intervention as well. So what should I do to help this person, and how do we both know it's working? If we provide that how do we both know it's working information back to the client, we also find that not only do they express greater satisfaction with the outcome, but they have greater confidence in that outcome. So they see a change, and they're confident in the size of the change, which leads to more positive behaviors after.
Now, you were speaking earlier about practitioners believing that they don't have the time to undertake this evaluation, or also feeling that they don't have appropriate training in how to undertake it. But Brian, you introduced an interesting concept in the text, and that's the idea of the professional practitioner. How does this work?
It's patterned after a concept in the psychology literature called local clinical scientist. Local meaning what's happening in the surrounding area that the practitioner is working. Clinical scientist, well, those are scary terms to people that are in counseling. So we called it instead professional practitioner. And really what it means is that it's centered around the client. We begin by looking at the client goals and barriers, basically the client context. And then we go to intervention planning and evaluation planning. What will I do with this client, and how will I tell how well it's working? And then we go and actually implement the intervention and collect the data that shows how much progress the client is making. So it means that the counselor is acting in a reasonably systematic fashion, not just doing any old thing with the client that walks through the door. So the counselor is behaving quite intentional, and that seems to be really a large part of how well it works. And so we're saying that people who use their own practice as a data source for the efficacy of the work they are doing, that those people are professional. And people who don't actually ever evaluate their work really aren't behaving in a very professional way. So that's what we're trying to get at there.
And to help practitioners be as professional as possible in their approach to their work, in the book you talk about the framework for client change as a model that can be used. And I thought it was interesting that you said when using this approach, it was important to you that it be relevant enough that practitioners in the field will actually use it, but at the same time comprehensive enough to cover the most important factors that actually influence client change. So how would this framework for client change work in practice?
Well, it begins with the client, an exploration of how the client wants to be different at the end of counseling compared to the beginning, and then moves into simultaneously looking at the different intervention alternatives deciding which one seems most appropriate with both the counselor and the client working together on that. And then actually deciding together what they will use as indicators of progress. And then to go and implement both the action plan and the collect the data that are indicating the progress that's being made. We introduced the notion called post-pre assessment, and that's one way of measuring client change across time that we've found to be very effective. It quite often is the case that people will enroll in a program and they're asked to rate themselves at the beginning of the program. At the end of the program, they end up rating themselves again, and the ratings are lower at the end of the program than they were in the beginning, because in the beginning, they didn't actually know what they didn't know about topic X. And so with this post-pre-evaluation, it's done only at the end, and it's done by creating the mindset, knowing what you know now about topic X. Think back to where you were when this program started and rate yourself. Think about where you are now and rate yourself, and then we get a measure of how much change the client has undergone.
I did notice that this post-pre-assessment tool was one of your favorites that you noted in the chapter, and I should also let listeners know that your chapter in the text contains a collection of really helpful and easy-to-use forms and checklists that practitioners can adapt to their work. So I would encourage them to look those up.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that, Sharon, because it really underscores what Chris was saying about this isn't a difficult thing that we're asking people to do. We're not suggesting that they take on the major workload. They've already got pretty heavy caseloads in most situations. But they just work it into their way of doing business so that they will be able to tell at a moment's notice, well, how's client X doing? Well, client X has moved from here to there. And then they're able to actually have a reasonable defense or the way in which they're intervening.
Now, to follow up on that, Chris, when it comes to integrating evaluation into practice, in the chapter you actually set out 7 stages that you recommend practitioners follow. And stage 1 is really about understanding context. And it was interesting that in the text you talk repeatedly in your work about finding mismatches between the kinds of services that are provided by practitioners and the actual needs of clients.
Yeah, that started quite a few years ago with colleagues Dave Redekop and Barry Day, and when we took a look at sort of the field of career services provision, we kind of roughly grouped them into 7 different levels of intervention depending on client need. And it could be all the way from a need for very intensive support. They're in a form of crisis and they need people to do things for them. Somewhere around the middle of that is where you have programmed interventions for groups of people. And at the top of the hierarchy were individuals who were quite capable of engaging in self-help and could function pretty much independently, provided they were given some gentle nudges and directions to follow. But there was little differentiation when a client entered a service as to whether or not this service was fitting this need. And so what we're talking about in the understanding the context is really 2 pieces. And the first piece of that is, what's the nature of the service that we are providing? And what's the nature of the client need? So we should be doing a more effective job of what in the medical world they call the triage for, you know, getting right treatment, right place, right time, than we typically do in the career area. So this was related to what we were talking about earlier with the misconceptions about a one-size-fits-all approach to client needs. And it really just is asking some simple questions. Who's receiving this service? What's the nature of our service? And how do we provide them? And are all those three things lining up? But the second set of issues that we need to look at is the general community or even broader context that the services are embedded in. We use the example in the textbook of a job finding service that reports a 70% success rate for its participants, and ask the question, well, is 70% a good number or not? Well, that depends almost entirely on the social and economic situation that those participants find themselves in. So if you've got a very highly depressed economy, if you're working or trying to work in an area where 80% of the people are unemployed, and you get to a 70% employment rate, you would say that was a fabulous intervention. But if you're working in an area where you've got 95% employment, and your program only helps to find 70% of your participants to find employment, well, now that's not such a good one. So you have to be able to speak about the kinds of client change that happens in the context of the social circumstances they're in, the cultural issues, the political issues, the economic issues, et cetera.
So getting that match right between the services provided and the clients is step one of the journey. And as practitioners continue on, a very common barrier that you write about in the textbook is that practitioners then try to do too much when it comes to evaluation and make the outcome list too long. So you give the example of a colleague wanting to see 70 different changes in students as a result of a course, but that's not practical. So your emphasis with the whole approach is really on ensuring that evaluation is not onerous.
Yeah, absolutely, and it's so important. And it's you know, we kind of laugh at that example. I consider that to be a great success, and it's very common when people kind of get the idea, they become true converts and they want to try to do everything, right? And they get almost a little too zealous in what they're trying to do. And we would highly recommend that it's better to have two or three or five really strong results that you can build on, that you can report with confidence and conviction, and that can lead to conceptualizing how you might do things differently for future iterations, than to have something like a 70-item list, because that big list is going to do three things. It's going to fatigue you as a service provider. It's definitely going to fatigue the participants. They're going to zone out, you know, a quarter of the way through any kind of impact measure documentation that you're doing. And it just confuses things way too much. When you have 70 different things going on, how do you know what the real themes are? So stick to two or three things that you can report on with confidence and then build on, because that will keep the process going.
That sounds like good advice, keeping it manageable.
Yeah.
Now, Brian, you say that one of the most important questions in looking at evaluation is how to integrate it in such a way that you can take the data and use it to influence how others value career development work. So how can practitioners best harness the power of evidence to make the case to funders or to policymakers that career development truly is an investment and not an expense?
The short answer to your question, Sharon, is tell everyone who needs to know in language they can understand. And so at some point you're going to collect data across the several people that are working at your agency. And if they've gone about it in a similar way, it's easy to aggregate that across the different counselors that you've got. And then you might have to prepare, I'm just guessing at numbers here, four or five or six different one-page or two-page max synopses of what you did and how well it worked. One that's intended for your boss, one that's intended probably more informally with your colleagues, perhaps also your boss's boss, so that he or she knows what a good job your boss is doing in the agency that he or she is managing. One for policymakers, looking especially at the policy implications, and making sure that evaluation actually gets built into the funding formula. And so it really, in the bottom line, harkens back to this question: would you invest in a program that doesn't have any viable evidence of success except for the verbal testimony of the people who actually offer the program? And I think the answer to that's going to continue to be no. So give the people who need to know the results that you've got, and do it in language that they can understand. So we're not talking about counselor jargon, we're talking about policymaker jargon, or we're talking about manager jargon, or whatever. So that's what I'm trying to say there.
So Chris, we know that there are these success stories out there where providers are effectively linking the outcomes they've achieved with the services that they're offering. But as Brian suggests, this isn't happening in a systematic way yet. So I guess my question to you is, on the whole, have we now actually proven the value of career development in society?
I don't think so. I think we remain at risk on this one. Brian and I had been invited, well, I think it's maybe 13 years ago or so now, to this national symposium, and the deputy minister for one of the large federal funding agencies gave a opening remarks to us where he basically said, you haven't demonstrated the value of career development services, so why should we in Canada fund it? And that kind of shocking statement was what led us to form this Canadian Research Working Group for Evidence-Based Practice. And we have seen some really encouraging practices starting to emerge. So I think the tide is turning. But by and large, we still have these forms of services offered more in the belief that they are effective than the evidence that they are effective. And so what this means to me is that career services continue to be vulnerable, and especially vulnerable in times of budget constraints.
Yeah, Sharon, it's Brian speaking. There are pockets where we're starting to get this kind of proof. Like in the GTO, there were the directors of career centers got together and decided that they were going to share the workload of creating evaluation forms, and they could all use them. And now we're starting to get some decent data rolling from that that's going to, I think, increase the likelihood that their funding isn't going to receive major cuts. But Canada-wide, Chris is absolutely right. It's not happening on a large-scale basis. Just in these pockets where people have gotten the message, they've tried it, they found that it isn't really very much more work than they were already doing, and they feel good about the results.
So to be successful on this evaluation journey, you say it really does begin with the reformulating of professional identity. So just as we wrap things up, I did want to take it back to the level of the individual practitioner. And what you advise in the book to practitioners is to start as soon as possible and not to worry about getting it 100% right. Chris?
Yeah, absolutely. If you think of any skill development, take your example, playing the piano, being a hockey player, writing good novels. Anything that requires skill takes practice. So with the notion of developing competence, which is knowledge, skills, and attitudes, around impact assessment, start with the assumption that some data is better than none, that you get better by doing, not by dreaming. Start with wherever you happen to be. Don't wait till you feel that you've become an expert in such things, but start with wherever you're currently sitting and take a step. And then know that practice, and particularly practice with feedback, leads to confidence. And confidence leads to better planning, and better planning leads to new goals. So incorporating evaluation, in our mind, is an example of continuous improvement. And thus, it's a form of professional engagements. So that's why we argue that incorporating evaluation into your practice is actually the hallmark of professional practice, and what differentiates the professional from the technician.
Well, thank you so much, Brian and Chris. I think you've certainly made the case for an evidence-based approach to career development practice, and you provided some really easy-to-implement evaluation tools for practitioners. You can learn more about their chapter in the new CEREC textbook, Career Development Practice in Canada. Find out how to get your copy at www.cerec.ca. Be sure to access our previous Text Talks podcasts with other leading contributors to the textbook. I'm Sharon Ferris for CEREC. Thank you all for listening.